Okay, I think we'll get started. Thanks for coming, everyone. It's a great honor to introduce Blake Hannaford, Professor Hannaford from University of Washington. And he's been touring around RI today, and we wanted him to really be at home, so we imported some of their weather here just for the day, make him feel at home. And tomorrow is supposed to be really nice. So anyway, so Blake's going to talk about doing surgery over the internet. I think there's probably some haptic component as well, maybe. We'll see. So I want to give a brief background. Blake got his BS from Yale back in 1977. MS and PhD from Berkeley. Then he went out and did a lot of engineering in various companies, I guess, for a while. And in 86 to 89, he was at JPL in the Man-Machine Systems Group. And I think that's where I met you, actually. Uh-huh. I was at JPL at a conference or something like that. So I think I've known you since 88 or 89, maybe something like that. So since 89, he's been a professor at University of Washington. He's also an adjunct professor of bioengineering, mechanical engineering, and surgery, so he's really spread pretty thin.
That's true.
He's gotten quite a few awards, like NSF Presidential Young Investigator Award, Early Career Award, IEEE Engineering and Medicine and Biology Society Award, and he's also an IEEE fellow. So, Blake, take it away.
Well, thanks. I want to thank you, Ralph, for inviting me. It's really the honor is really mine. This is I feel like I'm finally in the big time because I'm giving a talk at the Robotics Institute. So it's kind of a thrill. And again, thanks so much for inviting me out. And I've seen really cool and exciting labs and projects today. Some of which are famous, and some of which I haven't heard about, but they're going to be famous, and so it's been really fun. And thank you for coming to the talk. So I'm going to, I've titled it Design for Surgery Over the Internet because I'm going to emphasize a lot of design aspects of this project, and but there are a lot of aspects of what I do that we're probably not going to have time to touch on. You're welcome to. I'm also planning to kind of go fast and introduce a lot of different projects and sub-projects to keep everyone awake and interested. And so, if you want to hear more depth about something, shoot your hand up, or come see me after the talk. I'd be glad to go into that, or even dig more slides out of the computer. So I'll just acknowledge key collaborators. After you watch a few minutes of this talk, you'll see it's very obvious that I couldn't do this without a lot of great people helping out. And Mika Sininen is my original medical collaborator. We've been working together for over 15 years in weekly meetings. And as many of you know from experience here, especially at CMU, you get good results in the medical robotics area if and only if you have a substantial working relationship with clinicians. And that's not always easy to get. So Mika's been a huge thing. And then Jacob is a mechanical engineer and bioengineer who has contributed tremendous expertise to all these projects in mechanical design, dynamics, kinematics, beyond what I could do. And so he's really a co-leader and investigator of all of this. And then other MDs who've really helped us in one way or another. Rick, we've gone back with when he sponsored us sometimes as his other role at DARPA, and now we're more collaborators. He's a faculty member at UW. Tom Lenvay is a pediatric urologist who's only been working with us for about 2 years, but is really putting in extraordinary effort, and we're delighted. And then, of course, as you most of you know, many of you are students, and you know that who does the real work, and it's my job to talk about it. So I It's traditional to include an outline, but you're going to see it anyway, so I don't need to repeat it. So a little history. This field comes out of the field of telemanipulation, which goes back to the 40s. And the idea of remotely operating something or remotely manipulating back in the 40s especially was extremely avant-garde and risky and expensive idea. And you only would do that for some extremely high-value application, which in this case, unfortunately, was building nuclear weapons. And it wasn't until I went to the French Nuclear Research Center a couple of years ago, Ralph was there too, where they showed, they have 25 people working on haptics and teleoperation, and they showed us this note from Charles de Gaulle saying, we have to be self-sufficient in nuclear energy. And I realized that haptics originally was a enabling technology for nuclear weapons. And so here is a great video that Yasuo Yokokoji, an alumni of the Robotics Institute, obtained in Japan. And no one's ever seen this in America. By now, a lot of you have probably. But this shows the old, go away control panel. Okay. This shows the original technology and then, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I had this all fixed right before the talk, and now you're not seeing the video at all. I'm going to blow that off and just go on. And if you're really interested, come see this video after the talk. So a guy named Ray Gertz at Argonne National Labs developed these brilliant mechanical devices that let you manipulate through a 3-foot-thick leaded quartz window and handle these radioactive materials that were so radioactive you just could not handle them with, you know, tongs are fine if you can be 1 foot away, but if you have to be 10 feet away, tongs don't scale. And so you had to generalize tongs. And then these became more computer controlled in the 1980s and more commercialized in the 90s and productized. And in the zeros, if that's what we call them, the current decade, they became applied to medicine, which is also a high-value task. So that's a picture of Ray Gertz with one of his prototypes. So I will not show that video. This is my favorite old picture of the early days of remote through-the-wall manipulators, and I found this in some obscure postcard bin, and you know, I don't know what it is. My two theories are that it's an experiment on the toxic effects of cigarette smoke, or the other theory is it's an experiment on tele-seduction. And I'm not sure which it is, but I love this picture, and I try to show it a lot. And you can see what the point is, though, that she has enough dexterity to light that match without breaking it. Okay, that means she has force feedback. And then Fred Brooks got this device from Ray Gertz. It's one of his leftovers. And then in the 70s, hooked it up to a computer with graphics. So this was a huge step forward where you eliminate the other side and make it a virtual environment. And this is a drug molecule, and this is some receptor site. And this guy is manipulating the molecule and feeling the interaction forces and assessing the feasibility of this molecule binding to that receptor site. And I confess I don't know how significant that really is for the application of biochemistry, but it was a huge, really, really a breakthrough and a conceptual breakthrough. And only one of Fred Brooks's fantastic accomplishments. So then this 80s version allowed, the key here is you can put a mini computer in this system, and now the kinematics of the slave robot can be different from the master device. Before, they had to be identical so that you could just lock the joints together and electronically or mechanically, and then they would work. But Once you have computers, you can do coordinate transformations. And this is a device designed by Ken Salisbury. It was originally his PhD for a force-controlled robot. It's got all cable drives for low friction and lightweight. And Tony Batesy of JPL funded him to convert the endpoint from a gripper to a hand grip. And then it became a six-axis force feedback device, or haptic device. And this was a really good device back then, and it's still probably one of the best six-axis devices out there. Okay, and so here is the state-of-the-art in commercial FDA-approved surgical robots. Intuitive Surgical came out with this around 97 or 2000 or something like that. And the surgeon sits here looking at a console that's in stereo. There's two hand controls, and the image of the tool, this is not superimposed, but what the surgeon sees is that this is superimposed on his own or her own hand. And it's in stereo, and so you get this really compelling sensation that you're directly doing the surgery. However, there isn't any force feedback from this to the surgeon's hand, because even though this master device has motors in it that support force feedback, and they use it for certain supervisory functions in very clever ways, they could not get the force feedback function to a sufficient level of robustness that they could get it through the FDA. That's not to say it was rejected by the FDA, it's just that they chose not to go to the FDA with force feedback. And they've sold like 1,000 of them for $1.5 million each, and they do now they've done about 100,000 procedures, and it's growing exponentially, as is their price on the Dow Jones stock, on the New York Stock Exchange. So, but a thing about the Da Vinci is that the slave robot, by the way, it's very big. It takes up, this is not part of it, by the way, but this is. And it takes up close to half of the operating room, or the interesting real estate, which is around the patient. And then there's cables connecting it to this master side, but you can't separate them because they're, in fact, there's power links, power amplifiers for the robot are in here, and they go on long cables. And there's a newer version that just came out, which separates the power electronics, but there is still an optical fiber with a proprietary link between the two halves. So if you want to do telesurgery, it's not straightforward at all to just move this to some other place. An earlier system, this is the Zeus system from Computer Motion, and Jacques Marisco is a French surgeon. In 2001, he set up this in New York, and the robot in Strasbourg, France, performed a cholecystectomy, a gallbladder removal, on a live human patient, and he controlled it across the Atlantic Ocean. He was in a building in New York, a French telecom office, and was more or less plugged into the cable as it came out of the ocean, so that to minimize router delays and get a really good link, they had something like 150 milliseconds loop. This is not a force feedback system either. And it was a very successful thing. And it was not just a wild stunt that showed blatant disregard for human life. You might conclude that from just a picture. But they really prepared carefully. They did many tests. They had redundant backups for everything. And they did animal tests first. So it was a serious thing. And they really demonstrated a real capability. And then there's a surgeon, Mehran Envari, who is up in McMaster in Canada. And he took this system and did 25 human patients in the Hudson's Bay area, far northern Canada, where they have rather low access to especially specialty care. And he got permission from the Canadian health authorities and everything, and was really doing that clinically until this company got bought out by Intuitive Surgical, and that business was sort of shut down, that capability. Typical tools. This says Zeus on it because these tools come from the Zeus. And in fact, you'll see our robot, we decided we can't do everything. We're going to use the old Zeus tools on our robot for now. And so these are 5 millimeter shaft diameter. The Da Vinci is better because this has one wrist axis and the Da Vinci has two wrist axes, like the human wrist. And of course they both have roll. Roll is easy, you just roll this shaft, okay? But you need one more axis to pitch around here, and the Zeus never had that, which makes it less intuitive to operate. And so intuitive surgical really is more than a name or a marketing claim. You have to hand it to them. There's a lot of effort put into intuitive operation in that system. These are manual tools that don't have a wrist at all, but show sort of a variety of things that surgeons want to do. And again, the Da Vinci tools are 10 millimeters, twice as thick. Okay, I talked about Anvari's work. So we developed this robot starting in about 2002 for the Army, and the goal was surgical care quicker after the point of injury. There's a so-called golden hour. If you get the soldier to the treatment within an hour of injury, they have a much better chance of survival. No matter what a medic does during that hour, that's when the clock stops ticking. And the idea was, but surgeons, you know, you can't sort of stick a surgeon in every battle, and you also wouldn't want to. If a surgeon got injured, imagine that. Then you have to take the surgeon back to the hospital. You've got a whole crew working on the surgeon. You've just taken your medical capability out of commission, as well as it's just mushrooms. So they wanted a remote surgery. And we wanted to build something more compact than the Da Vinci that could mount on the operating table itself. Surgeons like to use gravity to manipulate internal organs. So they actually tip the table and your liver might sort of flop over advantageously so that they can get under it without hurting it through manipulating it. So this is sort of a flashback. Before we started that project, we spent several years just studying surgery itself, laparoscopic, minimally invasive surgery. This is a pig experiment. We developed this device called the Blue Dragon. The origin of that name is sort of obscure, but it's stuck. It is blue. You can't see it in this picture. There are two of them, actually. And it's a passive mechanism. I think I have a better picture of it. Yeah. Here's also two of them on their side. And they're four-bar linkages that track the motion of the endoscopic tools and record what the surgeon is doing. There's also a force torque sensor, which records the interaction force between the tool and the patient. Of course, this is a plastic phantom or simulator, but we did a lot of experiments on pigs. And we collected a big database of the motions and forces that are realistically required for surgery. And you know, in a single snapshot, you get sort of this massive polygraph strip of forces and torques and displacements and velocities. This is only part of the data set, actually, and we get 13 channels per hand and a sort of 26-dimensional vector. But what we're doing with it for the point of view of surgical robot design is analyzing that to get, well, design specifications for the robot. So we collect those into histograms, and we can say if the forces in a certain direction are limited to X, we can cover 99% of what the surgeons do. Or 95%, I think, was what we shot for, because it's very, very expensive to go for 100%. And we'd love it if the surgeons could do 95% of everything they wanted to do. We'd also with our design. There's a whole subtopic in a different talk that I could give some other time on skill assessment. And hidden within these two bullets is a key to, in my view, successful collaboration with MDs, and that is to make it a two-way dialogue where you work on cool technology. You know, we like cool technology, and having an MD partner legitimizes our goal, our desire to play with cool toys, right? Let's be honest. But at the same time, there's got to be something in it for the MDs. And so you have to listen to what they really are interested in and what problems they really have. And a lot of times they don't think as far ahead as we do. And so their problems seem like really near term or boring. I need a stronger suture that doesn't break, or I need a bigger needle that's a little bit bigger than the ones I already have. You know, those are not interesting. But they were very interested in particular Mikasinanan in skill assessment, quantitative skill assessment, because that's a mandate they're getting from the outside world. They have a very old-fashioned apprenticeship system, like in the Middle Ages, learning a craft from a master. If you become the apprentice to the master for 5 years, at the end of that, you can become a practitioner of that skill. And that's kind of the way medical residencies still work. It's very unstructured. There's no formal intermediate milestones and no quantitative tests that they have to pass. You just have to convince your mentor that you're ready to do it. And that's not good enough anymore. So we spend a lot of time with algorithms like machine learning from hidden Markov models to take this mess and infer skill from it. So hidden Markov models, as you probably know, are one of the leading techniques. At least they were a few years ago. They're kind of a classical technique now for speech recognition. And we said, what if we train a hidden Markov model on all this data from experts, from beginners, two separate hidden Markov models, of course. And then we have a presumed level of skill because we have five cohorts, the first year, second year, third year, fourth year, and fifth year residents. And we could train an HMM for each of those groups because we collected data from all of them. So that's a side topic that we could talk about some other time. So back to the design. We wanted to make it smaller and more dexterous, aim to provide force feedback. That's not a goal that you write in the proposal. You say provide force feedback, but I'm changing the goal a little bit now because we haven't achieved it yet. Increase mobility and ability to operate on its own in terms of to just illustrate this, the surgeons wanted to move the Da Vinci from one operating room to another. So they called the technician, and they started wheeling it along, and there's a little like aluminum lip over an expansion joint in the floor in that hallway that's about half an inch high. And this was after they got it in the elevator, and the elevator sunk an inch when they put it in the elevator. And they had to get it to roll it over that half-inch expansion joint was accomplished by the intuitive technician, and one of the arms broke and had to be replaced. Okay, so it's not exactly a field mobility unit. And I'm not knocking Intuitive Surgical. It's a fantastic path-breaking product. It just doesn't do everything. So increasing mobility, and then evaluated in experimental surgery. So we early on went with a spherical mechanism idea. And many of you probably understand this idea. This is really a two-link arm where that plane, instead of the plane from your elementary robotics textbook, it's wrapped around a sphere. And so the axes of motion, this axis and this axis and this axis, this axis, by the way, is an in and out axis for the tool, they all intersect at that point. Okay, a virtual point. And we picked this radius early on based on the kind of trocars or ports that you have to insert in minimally invasive surgery and the growing waistlines of the American public. Okay, so what this mock-up, this is an early, just sort of trial unit. What it doesn't show is that there's little thumb screws in the back, and these slide apart So the key design variable is what is this angle between Z1 and Z3 and between Z3 and Z5? And I'll tell you why they're odd numbers later. And traditionally, you make those 90 degrees and you have a gimbal and you can cover the entire sphere. But we knew we didn't need to cover the entire sphere. We discovered from those experiments that 95% of the operation takes place in a 60-degree cone. And so we didn't want it, we wanted this to be as compact as possible. So we decided to do a numerical optimization on the two link angles. That's not joint angles. That's really link lengths on a sphere. So we call them angles in a spherical mechanism. And we wanted to have really good performance in terms of kinematic isotropy in a 60-degree cone. But then we lost our nerve a little bit. We said, OK, but we really want to reach a 90-degree cone just in case. Okay, so rather than a super clean, idealized mathematical optimization, we say it has to at least reach a 90-degree cone. But the kinematics can be close to a singularity outside there. But in the 60-degree cone, we need to be far away from singularities. And we don't want any singularities in the workspace. And then we also had to decide serial versus parallel. So here's a parallel mechanism, and here's a serial mechanism. They're both spherical mechanisms. And parallel mechanisms have some really cool properties, like stiffness and speed. But they have some limitations, like workspace compared to their envelope. And so if you're a parallel mechanism fan, don't be offended that this is a smackdown. This is just a joke. I mean, this is not in any way the definitive serial versus parallel result. Okay, I wanted to use a parallel mechanism. But what we did is all these tests where using the realistic geometry that we had, including this 13-centimeter radius, and you have to put these ports 10 centimeters apart typically, we just had this problem of elbows bumping into each other and getting really close to each other when we set this up. And we even tried a hybrid with one parallel and one serial. But in the end, we went with serial because of this issue. Sometimes these elbows would hit the patient as well. So it just isn't room in that crowded. Somebody has said that this area right here is the most expensive real estate in the world, that little zone above the patient. I think Russ Taylor coined that term. But you've got to conserve it. And so here's some more of these tests we did with the mock-up. And so let's get back to, now we've got a serial mechanism chosen. And so then isotropy means that in the sense of the Jacobian and its eigenvalues, we have good motion properties in all directions, all being two in this case. And you can use the condition number, it's the inverse of the condition number of that matrix. Inverting it, Ken Salisbury, I think, invented that. And that's good because it goes from 0 to 1 instead of 0 to an infinite number. And then, so each point in the workspace, though, the arm is at a different pose. And 1 is what you want. What happened there? Well, that's interesting. OK. So then Mitch Lum wrote software that scanned this whole workspace and found the 60-degree cone for a given mechanism candidate. That is, we chose these two link angles within a certain range. And I'm not going to go into all the details of what these plots are, but this is kinematic isotropy versus the two angles. And so you get some singular configurations. And we want to put a workspace into those red and yellow zones. And so then this is, sorry, yeah?
Quick question. I was thinking, why did you use manipulability as a measure instead of isotropy? And I think I know why, because you want something measured in the workspace. So now I was thinking, what about some generalization of the workspace density functions that Greg Trichian thought of? The idea where you have a volume of workspace, and if it's more, the number gets higher if there's more configurations that can get that volume of workspace. And I was wondering, is that the same thing as isotropy, or is it something?
No, I think that's something different, because there's only two solutions for this arm, right? For any of these points.
Right.
So there aren't more configurations. This isn't kinematically redundant or anything.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't think that's the same thing.
That answers my question. Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
And so this says that these are the two link angles, and this was the best design right here and here. And this is the 60-degree cone, and this is the bigger space that it can reach. So it was the these two angles are what we machine those links to eventually. And then we set our mock-up to those two angles, and we had the surgeons do a pig procedure. And so this is sort of this interesting hybrid between humans and a mocked-up robot. But the point was that they stuck their tools into the ports. This is the pig's stomach blown up with inflated with CO2. And this is the way they normally do the procedure. But we stuck these passive arms on there. And then we could verify that these elbows didn't collide with the pig's stomach, and that there were no collisions between the two things, and that the surgeons were not constrained, and they had the room to move. And this went very well. In fact, so well that we realized this was a better way to do the Blue Dragon, our big pantograph tracker. And in fact, we're commercializing a tool tracker based on that spherical passive mechanism. But the original purpose of it was to figure out what these link lengths should be. And so they're like 52 and 30 degrees. And so this is the CAD model that sort of came from that. These links, they don't look curved because they're straightened out, but the axes are still embedded in a sphere, or still intersect right at that point where the tool intersects the patient. And we bought a used operating table, and we added a special frame inside, and added these big linear lead screw actuators so that the arm can be positioned and ride up and down the table. Version, we built a passive, rigid, adjustable arm to position the spherical mechanism around the patient. And you just lock it with these levers. And we are now completing motorized arms that move the robots around the patient. So these are some early pictures of the prototype. Since it's black, it's kind of hard to see, so I'm going to give you a lot of pictures. This is another view without the covers. So there's six motors here. I call it the six-pack. They're almost arranged like a six-pack. And then pulleys and cables going around and through the joints. And then this is a linear motion axis for the tool to go in and out. Three of the cables run up through these pulleys onto pulleys here, so they can actuate internal degrees of freedom in the tool. And this is a custom tool attachment fixture that one of our postdocs designed so that we can snap the tools in and out. And it's adapted so that you can do it with one hand. With the Da Vinci, you have to use two hands. And so a robot with a parallel jaw gripper could remove and change these tools. And this shows the business end. This is one of the Zeus tools connected to the arm. We've made covers that look somewhat better. You know how research is. We hardly ever use it with the covers on. But they exist. And nowadays, with solid rapid prototyping, you know, you can build parts that would only be done with injection molding otherwise. And so we build these big things out of shells out of RP. And we also got, this is the electronics, which is now, all of this is now combined into one box. I think I have Well, I'll get to the electronics later. This is Diana Friedman, who was a key mechanical designer in this and is a ME PhD student, and this is Jacob Rosen, who was a key mentor to these students and to me. So electronics and control we had to build. These are Maxon motor control units. This is the back of the box and this is the front of the box. We have actually two of these, one for each of the two arms. And the key thing that we wanted to do is, from painful previous experience, we wanted to keep the computer and the robot completely separate and not have to stuff a lot of electronics boards into a computer case, because then it's difficult to upgrade your computer or swap it out. So we wanted everything to be USB 2.0. And that turned out to be a fairly time-consuming effort. But we designed this board, and so whatever computer you want, this is just a generic rack mount computer, can control this by a single USB connection. Denny Trimble designed the actual links and pulley cable routes, and he has moved on to Jeff Bezos' spaceflight company. If you become a space tourist, you might be riding in his rocket. Again, more of the team, Jesse Dozier, key electronics, Hawkeye, a key software guy, Mitch, a key, he did the kinematic design and optimization, and also a sort of system integration. So what's the control architecture for operating this remotely over the internet? So the idea is, of course, to have just a internet link, TCP/IP link, between the master side and the robot side. The robot is really here. It's not sort of missing from this block diagram. And this is our board that we had to design. These three software modules run in RTAI Linux, the real-time Italian version of real-time Linux. And the surgeon's interface runs on Windows, I believe, but it's coded in Qt4, so it can be ported to any operating system or any common one. So the control itself was modular with a standardized data structure that sort of had the robot state in different coordinate systems and actuator space and so forth. In one sort of blob, so that we could pass that around to the different routines. The control loop runs at 1,000 hertz. And then we put some thought into safety. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So this is the e-stop button. And this is sort of my prompt to talk about safety. And they put in an e-stop button, and I said, no, I want a bigger e-stop button. And this was the biggest one they could find. So the first thing is an e-stop button. And our safety goals, what were our safety goals? Well, we want reliable and robust use for animal experiments. So we're so far only talking about non-survival animal experiments. It's really okay if it fails during an animal experiment, but it's a waste. And we also don't want a super sensitive safety system that's constantly turning the robot off and requiring us to reboot and restart. And we also don't want to damage the equipment by some software bug that puts the full current into the actuators and gets stuck there. But at the same time, I realized that we don't have the resources to really do a full FDA-approvable human-rated safety at this time. And I've actually consulted with the FDA, and I know what that involves. So I'm not by any means claiming this is true safety, that what you're going to see, but it's just we didn't want to ignore safety either, like so many people do in the lab. So our principle was that the software is always broken and wrong. And you just assume the software is wrong. So we're going to make a hardware system that we can verify and that's robust, that will keep it going through a little state machine in a rational manner that doesn't guarantee safety, but at least we can have a lot of confidence in it. So we want that to be simple and robust so it's verifiable. We want the hardware e-stop, of course. We want the surgeon in control, kind of regardless of what software does. We really would hate it if the surgeon feels lag because the operating system is swapping or something like that, especially in a safety-related function. And again, we don't trust our software even though we wrote it ourselves. So the idea is that the Linux RTAI system does the control and actuation, and the safety system is hardware run by a programmable logic controller, and the hardware is running this state machine with four states, e-stop, and then initialize, which is when it's moving around checking its encoders at the beginning. And then a start signal tells it to go into pedal up. And so the surgeon has a foot pedal, and pedal up means it's all running, everything's engaged, but the brakes are turned on and the motors are off. But pedal down disengages the brakes and turns on the motors. Okay, so the surgeon wants to operate, they put their foot down and operate, and when they want to take a break, they just take their foot off. And so that pedal down, pedal up function is done in hardware based on the signals that come through from the pedal. And so all of that state, all state transitions are done in this a programmable logic controller, this industrial bulletproof logic controller. It's kind of like an electronic version of a bunch of relays. And then the software is slave to those state transitions. So the software goes through those same states, but only in response to what the PLC does. And the software sends a heartbeat signal, and the PLC implements a watchdog timer as one of those state transitions. So that's our little micro PLC that does the state machine and is robust to power surges and all that. And we had to design this board, which is a USB 2 interface, and it handles 8 optical encoders and 8 analog outputs, 8 DACs, and they connect right here to amplifiers, and these connect to the optical encoders. And this can read all the optical encoders, send a packet, and receive a packet and update the 8 voltages in 125 microseconds. So we really operate at 1,000 hertz deterministically. And then we didn't really have any funding to make a really nice advanced user interface to this. So we had to kind of scrap things together. And so we have a laptop and 2 Phantom Omnis, the cheapest haptic device at the time, a USB foot pedal, and either the laptop's video display or an external monitor, and then our own software. So the system looks kind of like this. Here's a GUI for the surgeon. It tells them which of the 4 states with a kind of color-coded square, so they know the state of the system. And these are the 2 Phantom Omnis, and this is a little manipulation task that they're looking at. And this video is coming from something external. Sometimes it's just right on the laptop. I think I'll skip this. It's fairly straightforward. And not go into too much detail about the surgeon's GUI and the haptic device client. Okay, so communication is UDP packets. As you might know, UDP packets are faster than the most packets, like our websites, are TCP packets, and they're slower. They have more overhead, but they're guaranteed to arrive. They have lots of error checking mechanisms. UDP packets are fast and unreliable, but we need that speed to send this many packets per second. And we're sending incremental motion commands to the robot and very carefully keeping state information out of them and keeping the states in the robot and not in the big loop. So if you drop packets, it really doesn't matter because we're sending, literally the increments in the packets are microns. And if you lose a micron, so what? The surgeon sees the error eventually and corrects it if it builds up significantly. So this is what the packets look like in terms of C, and it's, you know, small increments and microradians for rotation. And a few things like foot pedal and button state. We haven't been too, as you can see, we haven't been too conservative with packing data in there very tightly. Okay, how do we get the video back? So that's really like a whole nother technology, and we didn't decide, we're not really going to be innovators on everything. We're just going to find something that works. So we want high quality as possible. We want low encoding and decoding latency. Some of the technologies are designed for things like on-demand movies. So if there's a 3-second latency and you're at home watching a movie, you couldn't care less. But that's really bad for doing telesurgery. And low cost is nice. So the things we've been using are the two extremes of cost. So Hi-Vision HAI 500 hardware codec is a box that costs $80,000. The NFL buys them for encoding their games and things like this. And we got them for like 1-week loans for some of our projects. They can, and you can put one at each end, or you can just have a computer at the receiving end. And of course, they're very configurable. You can make a trade-off between resolution and speed. So these give very nice pictures. In fact, I believe this is, you can't, this is of course a, sorry, I won't go back that far. But they can give really, really nice pictures and compress them pretty effectively, but, you know, into 3 or 4 megabits per second. But they do still have latency. The other extreme is Skype and iChat, okay, which are free. And the chief difference, we spent a bit of time evaluating them. The chief difference is that with Skype, the sound, the video is delayed and the sound is less delayed. So you see a disconnect between sound and video. And iChat solved that in a simple way. They delay the sound to match the video, okay? Which is a good thing to do. You want that, okay? Because even though it's more delayed, it looks better. So here's a project from last spring. And Tim Broderick of the University of Cincinnati and the Army and NASA came to us and said, let's take your, a little less than two years ago. Let's take your robot out to a remote site and start to get a feel for what it's going to take to have telesurgery in remote sites. And I think at this point I am going to switch to a video, which I think will work.
Allow the use of robots.
If I can find it now.
Space situations.
Great. I'm cutting into demonstration.
The concept of the trauma pod is a suite of robotic instruments.
Okay. Whoops. Okay, here we go.
Man down.
This is a DARPA promotional video. What's going to happen in combat in the future? So a guy's been injured. Robots take him away from the battle zone and put him into this special unit called the trauma pod. By the way, this is a component that we wound up developing for TraumaPod, a rotary tool holder and tool changer.
Man
And then this will show the beginning of our, a little bit about our HapSmart project.
The ideal surgical robot of the future, the image guided, the ability to mock W. Raven's robot last year. The robot was deployed in the field in the high desert of the Simi Valley, California.
So you saw our robot over there and Diana operating it. This is the master side.
Here we have Timothy Broderick, a surgeon from the University of Cincinnati, controlling the surgical robot through two Omni Phantom Arm controllers. In the battlefield, reliable telecommunications is an issue. The military is currently using unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs.
This is built by a company called AeroVironment in Simi Valley. And we're actually in their field testing area.
Between the control station and the surgical robot.
This is not, these antennas are not the normal configuration. And I'll tell you a funny story about that afterwards offline. So here's the robot sort of initializing itself.
Here you can see the robot
in the field.
Performing number of tasks.
And here it is. One of the tasks we had was to touch these points. So this, the video and the control signals are going through that UAV by a wireless link back to the surgeon.
Using control of the robot over a microwave connection from an overhead UAV.
It's about 100 degrees out there.
This spring, we were involved in a NASA mission.
I'll show this, and we'll talk about this one as well.
This surgical robot was taken to an undersea environment, the Aquarius.
This is
Aquarius is located under 10 meters of water off the coast of the Florida Keys. Aquarius is used by NASA to test technologies for deployment in eventual space missions, and is also used for team training and simulations. In the NEMO 12 mission, surgeon Timothy Broderick from the University of Cincinnati was stationed underwater with a team of astronauts and scientists. The robot was taken down by a team of Navy divers and set up in the underwater environment. Then it was controlled by surgeons stationed at the University of Washington using standard internet links. In order to standardize performance metrics for surgical robotics, our lab has now adopted the fundamentals of laparoscopic surgery as a set of standard tasks that can be duplicated using...
Okay, I'm going to stop this there as we get more into surgery stuff. So let's see how that worked, how we did that. So this is the AeroVironment UAV. It was flying about 1,000 feet up and often as far as 1,000, as far as a kilometer down range. But we could still get a good wireless data link in both directions, it running internet protocol. This shows where their site is. This is kind of the edge of urban sprawl of Los Angeles. And then there's all this beautiful land up here that's owned by an oil company. And it's sort of, there's a few cows grazing. That's approximately where we were. And these cases are... They sell these to rock bands for their sound equipment so they can take them on the road. So these are shock mounts, and this was very effective for protecting our electronics. This is a big power supply, and then these are those two electronic amplifiers that I showed you, or amplifier boxes. This turned out to be way over-designed. So in our new version, we got rid of this and made it only about 1 inch thick, and now we have our computers in there as well. So we loaded this stuff up and got down to this site in Simi Valley. You can see a couple of cows. And we had to take it out there and set up every day and take it back down for certain reasons. So both of these field experiments, we've been criticized a little bit for not getting much science or data out of them. And I agree with that criticism. It's valid. But it's so difficult to do it and get these things set up that it's hard to actually get a lot of performance data once you're there. This is sort of a panorama that shows the system, the two sites. We probably should have made them farther apart. the airplane's a kilometer downrange, you certainly don't need to be close. But we did all kinds of tests to make sure that the wireless system wasn't just directly talking to the two between the two tents. And these are the AeroVironment team, and you see this, he's holding this Puma vehicle, and then he just hand launches it like that. And this guy's holding a little console that flies it. And it's not like an RC hobby plane in the sense that it's got much higher level control interface. So you just drive it around with a joystick over the GPS map, and you dial in the altitude you want. And when you find a target, you just press circle, and it automatically circles. And then it has a button called auto land. So it's a very high-level user interface. This was one of the constraints that we had to operate under. So this is a really junky old generator for the power. And in fact, of the two, we built a nice surge protection system into our system, but it refused to work with one of these generators. And so we had to, fortunately, it worked with the other one. Again, you can see the console, and that's the team. And then Nemo 12 was a little more ambitious, but also Tim Broderick's idea. And SRI was also involved. Their system went down into the Aquarius habitat as well. So the idea was, again, to kind of push this and work out as many bugs as possible to maximize the chances of success. In this case, the Raven system had to be taken down in bags, dive bags, and pots. And so it had to be completely taken apart. And our team couldn't be down there to put it back together. So we had to train the surgeon, Dr. Broderick, and an astronaut in our lab for 3 days on how to take it apart and put it back together and start it up. So we did that, and they were successful at that. Another thing is it's 2 atmospheres of pressure down there, and hard drives really don't like that. Either dust is forced into them, or their cases deform and jam the bearings. So we had to replace it with solid-state disk drives. This is the kind of pots that all the pieces come down in. This is in the bottom of Aquarius, bringing it back up. And we still have a little bit of rust on our linear bearings to prove it. And this is the robot set up in the underwater habitat. This is a camera. And so we operated from Seattle into this habitat. And that was successful. So here's Dr. Lenve. And this is video from the Aquarius habitat coming through a microwave link from the buoy into their base and then through the internet to our lab. And one of the things, what we find in this kind of experiment is that the lag for commands is about, the round trip internet ping time for these connections is about, for coast to coast, it's about 120 milliseconds now. But the longer lag component comes from the video coding and decoding. And this was using those high-vision expensive boxes. So that's more like half a second to a second. So internet delays are actually not the limiting factor now. It's actually video compression and decompression. With Skype and iChat, it's a full second. So you might as well be teleoperating on the, well, not quite the moon, but way out in space in terms of speed of light equivalent.
What's the continuous throughput in terms of bandwidth?
Well, I'm not sure we accurately measured that. We've really focused on measuring the time delays.
If it's broad enough, you don't need the codec.
Yeah, that's true. But I think to get quality high definition is like, or actually not high def, digital NTSC is like 25 megabits per second raw, okay? And we'd never get that across the country from NERC. So we did, this is last September. We did a couple of connections from Europe This is at the European Surgical Robotics Summer School, and we had a bunch of grad students who got to try our system in Seattle, and all they had to do was supply us with a couple of PCs and a couple of Omnis, and our software could connect. So we got, because we were constrained by budget, we made this little simple user interface, but now we have this sort of disruptive capability, which is we can connect to it from anywhere. We can have collaborators from Europe and Asia operate our robot. So I think we're more or less out of time. If you're interested, this is a prompt to look at some other slides if people have time or are interested. And this is getting into more detail about the time delay. What are the delays and how do they affect teleoperation? And shared haptic devices, shared haptic collaboration. So I just graduated a PhD student, Ganesh Shankaranarayanan, who has studied the effects of network delays on shared haptics, where you have two people touching an object. Boeing originally started this research with us because they wanted their network of international suppliers to interact with CAD systems online. And we found some very interesting, first thing we did was we didn't want to simulate this. We argued about what kind of characteristics you'd have to simulate. So instead of that, we just put packet reflectors around the world and sent our packets on the real internet. And so we were studying global collaboration within our own lab. Let me see if I can get a little bit of that, since people seem to be... Feel free to leave if you're constrained for time.
5 minutes, maybe? Right?
Yeah.
Like 5 minutes?
Yeah, I won't do a whole huge thing. I just want to show about three slides. This is longer, but I'll get to the three slides that I want to show. Don't be scared by that long progress bar. You're not going to be here all night. Okay, so this is the basic idea that you're going through the internet. But because we had a packet reflector, our two users are in the same room. But they're still collaborating on a global scale. I've got a slow slide here. Okay, here's the one I wanted to show you. So this is time, and this is delay. And these are three links. One is a local, right in the same lab. Then this is going to UBC, which is our closest major university. And then North Carolina State, which is on this coast, or not really this coast, but then to Italy in Scuola Superiore Sant'Anna. So this is showing that the delay is pretty stationary with these occasional blips. And that's kind of a consistent feature. Going to other countries, you go through a few gateways, and so the difference is not as big as the difference should be bigger than it looks here. And then this other one is a logarithmic histogram of delays. So these are log of time delay, and these are the different links: local, UBC, North Carolina State, and Scuola Superiore Sant'Anna. And so there's these long tails, even though we did an earlier type of study like this about 10 years ago, and the network is faster now, and it's tighter. The variances have gone down, and all of these numbers change. In fact, when Ganesh made these measurements, and then like a month later, they were totally different. And he found out that our university had switched over to a new backbone that went to these same places, but with higher connectivity. And in fact, the delays didn't change much, but the variances did when they switched backbones. So I think that's what I'm going to conclude with. And I'll thank you very much for listening. And then if you do have questions, feel free to ask them now or just hang around or send me an email later. Thanks again.
Okay. Any questions?
Bobby?
Like, how do you see haptics getting into this?
Well, it's the Holy Grail. We want, so we have the pieces sort of in place. And we're, you know, again, this is like a struggle to get it all working. And nobody wants to put the close that loop more than I do. And we have the, you know, haptic devices, the Omnis. We have some other haptic devices on the master side and the capability to close that loop. But I don't really have... Well, this is the thing. There are big technical obstacles. So how do you sense it on the slave side? And then even if you had like an ideal perfect sensor that was tiny, robust, and sterilizable, there's still this big system issue of the time delays. And you also have lags. When you put the sensor, say, down at the tooltip, you're controlling the system through the motors. So you have these other dynamics injected into the loop. Even if you didn't have the time delays, you also have the friction and other things that are hard to model. So I don't have like a breakthrough, you know, solution to that right now. Once we get a few more of the technical details of open loop, you know, sort of wrung out, then we'll start experimenting and closing that loop just with the joint space position error, the traditional way. When we do that, we're going to feel a lot of the dynamics of the mechanism, although it does have a dynamic model in it right now that does do gravity compensation. So in fact, one of the original videos you saw from the Simi Valley thing, the arm looks a little shaky. And now we have implemented gravity compensation, so the controller is much, let's say, it's better control, so it's not so shaky anymore because the gravity compensation part is taken care of open loop. So using that, we can subtract that gravity component out from the force feedback that the user would feel, for example. And I've got a new student working on modeling the friction in the mechanism and so forth. So we want to get there. I think there's, you know, of course we could just hook something up, but it just wouldn't work at first. It's still a big project. It's still a goal, and I wouldn't say that what we've done so far has advanced that goal, frankly, yet.
Any other questions? Bert, let's take
first. So what's the fail-safe mode if something goes wrong? Do things just stop where they are?
Yeah, brakes. So the motors, the power is removed to the motors and the brakes, and the brakes are fail-safe. When power is removed to the brakes, they lock.
So it's rigid.
Right. And that's the way, that's fairly accepted thing for these medical devices. And then there's various, you know, if we were to make this human rated, we'd have to have some manual override to back it out. That's the kind of thing we aren't worrying about yet.
So I think probably we should cut it off at this point and thank our speaker again, and then anybody wants to talk afterwards. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Very welcome.